Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Last year, devastating hurricanes, extreme wildfires, floods, tornadoes, and droughts in the United States cost a record $306 billion. Just recently, the world's leading intergovernmental panel on climate change warned that we have just 12 years to limit a climate change catastrophe. Given the dire consequences of climate change, along with the Republican Party's aggressive efforts to roll back environmental protections, a record number of scientists are running for Congress tomorrow, and several organizations are ranking candidates based on their positions to tackle global warming. According to the Environmental Voting Project, more than 15 million people who rank the environment as a top-tier issue did not vote in the 2014 midterms. So the Environmental Voting Project is working very hard to get them to the polls tomorrow. They have mobilized 1,800 volunteers to knock on doors, send text messages, and make calls to urge people who care about the planet to get out and vote. And today we're joined by Nathaniel Stinnett. He's the founder of the Environmental Voter Project, an organization that's working to get more environmentalists to the polls. And Nathaniel Stinnett joins us from Boston. Hi, Nathaniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. And we're joined by Marianne Lavelle, an award-winning reporter covering the environment, science, law, and business for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization focused on climate change, energy, and the environment. And Marianne Lavelle joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Marianne. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us again. Nathaniel, I want to start off with you. I was really surprised to read that more than 15 million people who rank the environment as a top-tier issue did not vote in the last midterm. How did you all come up with that number?
Yeah, so we take the same approach that a lot of sophisticated political campaigns now take when they're targeting voters, and that is we build predictive models. And rather than give you the really, really long, in-depth answer for what predictive models are, I'll try to give you the quick answer. We poll tens of thousands of people per state and ask them what their top priorities are. Then, when we isolate the people who list climate or the environment, we do the same thing that insurance companies do. We try to figure out what interesting data points there are about these people. So just like when you apply for life insurance, you need to tell them your health history and your medical history and how much you smoke or how much you drink, we poll people and we try to figure out what makes environmentalists unique. And when we find that information, we then build a model to try to find other people like that in various states. And it sounds kind of complicated and convoluted, but at the end of the day, it's enormously accurate. Because when we build these models, we'll then ship them out and have them tested by polling companies, and they're often 90-95% accurate. So That's how we identify environmentalists, and it's also how campaigns identify people. And then it's pretty easy. You don't need to be a data scientist to figure out who votes and who doesn't vote. That's public record.
Right. 15 million is a lot of people. That could sway elections. Do you know why these people who recycle and bike and who care about the planet don't vote?
So it's a great question, and we know part of the reason, but unfortunately only part of the reason. So what we do know is there are a lot of demographic correlations between environmentalists and groups of people who habitually don't vote. So for instance, if you are young, or if you're African-American, or if you are Latino, you have a much higher likelihood of deeply caring about climate change and other environmental issues. But those demographic groups I just mentioned also historically don't vote as often as the rest of the population. But here's the interesting thing, Rose. That doesn't give us all of the answer. That doesn't tell us all of what's going on here. Because even if you only look at young people, the environmentalists vote less often than other young people. Or even if you only look at Latinos and Latinas, the environmentalists vote less often than other Latinos. And we don't know what's going on there. I wish we had the answer, but it's kind of a black box. The good news is, even though we're not sure why these people aren't voting, we do know how to get them to vote. So that's what we focus on.
Marianne, you extensively cover climate change. What do you think about that number? 15 million people who rate the environment as a top issue doesn't vote.
Amazing. And Nathaniel's, they're doing such interesting work on a really important subject, because it's very clear that most people believe in climate change. They believe in the science. They believe that it's happening. They very strongly are in favor of renewable energy and clean energy. But the issue of it being at the top of their list of what they're voting on, that is a smaller number of people. And I think what Nathaniel's work is to try to isolate those people. One thing, and I wonder what he thinks of this, I was talking to some of the folks who've looked closely at the youth vote. And one of the things that seems to be clear is that young people don't have a great deal of faith in institutions to address big problems like climate change. I can't blame them for feeling that way because of how poorly our institutions have dealt with climate change. But the problem is that just, changing your light bulbs and driving an efficient car, just that individual sort of virtuous work is not going to be enough to tackle climate change. It has to be institutions, not only statewide, but nationally and internationally, working together on this very big existential problem for the planet.
Hmm. What about that, Nathaniel?
So I think Marianne is absolutely right that if you ask a lot of young people, they will say that they don't have faith in government, that they don't think the political process responds to what they care about, and that they don't think that their vote makes a difference. However, I think we need to be careful about saying that that is a cause of them not voting. It is absolutely the excuse that they give, and there's absolutely that correlation there. But what's really interesting is if you poll really good voters, and again, this is all public record, so you know who votes and who doesn't vote. And if you poll people who never miss an election, people who even vote for dog catcher and library trustee, and you ask them if they think their vote matters, most of them will also say, nah, I don't think it matters. And most of them will also say, I don't think politicians are that responsive to the things I care about. So I think Marianne is onto something, but I don't know how strong a causal relationship there is between that apathy and not voting. Because the truth is, a lot of people who hate politicians and don't think voting matters still show up on election day. And so something weird's going on here, and I'm not going to pretend like we have our finger on the answer.
What are you have a number of volunteers out knocking on doors, calling people, texting. For those volunteers who have face-to-face interactions with potential voters, what are they hearing?
So we're certainly hearing that in particular areas, and I imagine Marianne will be able to speak to this much more than I will, but we're seeing in particular areas, climate change and environmental issues are a much bigger political priority than we've seen in the past. I mean, places like Florida, places like Nevada and Wisconsin, we are it's hard to pick up the phone. It's hard to knock on a door without people screaming about environmental issues, particularly in Florida. Now, obviously, we're preaching to the choir. The Environmental Voter Project only talks to people who deeply care about the environment, but it's still extraordinary. It's still a change. And, you know, we're not going to know what goes on until after the votes are counted. But it feels like, when you look at early voting data and when we're hearing what our volunteers are saying, it feels like this time's a little different for the environmental movement.
What would you say? Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Marianne? I mean, it's getting so much more attention, and people are really feeling it firsthand. They're either feeling it directly or they know someone who has felt it directly.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that I know Nathaniel's group, they're preaching to the choir, but the candidates themselves, they're talking to their whole constituency. And what we're seeing, again, particularly in Florida, but also in Virginia, in Iowa, in Washington State, in Nevada, in just across the country, there are places where candidates, both the Republican and Democrats, are debating over who's going to be better in addressing these environmental issues. Now, that's really different. Climate change is not, they're not debating whether it's happening or whether it's important or not. They're sparring really over who's going to be the best and get things done on this issue. And that really is an important turning point that we should take note of. It means that this issue is gaining some traction. At least the candidates feel it is. They're basing it on their own polling. They feel it's gaining traction even and despite and perhaps because of the federal government right now moving in the other direction, kind of retreating from even acknowledging climate change. That's not what's happening on the campaign trail this year.
What else stands out for you, Marianne, when you listen specifically for candidates to express their views on the environment? The New York Times had a piece about how candidates are not shying away from talking about climate change. Florida's contest for governor, for example, Ron DeSantis, the Republican, said he didn't want to be an alarmist. I mean, the Republicans always say, I'm not a scientist, right? That's usually their line. Andrew Gillum, a Democrat, said he would be a governor who believes in science. It's very basic language that they're still using in some cases. But the Times also found that candidates in tight House and Senate races are becoming less shy about putting climate change on the airwaves, and they're using ads to attack their opponents' views and then also, you know, brag about their green credentials. So what stands out for you? Are candidates going beyond the line that they actually believe in science? It's kind of amazing that candidates have to say that in 2018.
Right. I think in some cases they're tying themselves up in knots to say that they believe in the science, but yet don't depart from the Republican Party's views. An example is in the Nevada Senate race. The incumbent Republican Dean Heller at the last debate said several times, I'm not a climate denier. But then he went on to say, you know, we still don't know how much human activity is responsible for the climate change we're seeing. Well, that's not really an acceptance of the science. The science is very clear that human activity is the main driver of the warming that we've seen this century. So there are all of these different ways the Republicans who are trying to appeal to voters who at least don't want a climate denier to be representing them. Another example is in Virginia's 2nd District, which covers the whole waterfront of Virginia. There is an ad by an outside group that is supporting the incumbent Republican, Scott Taylor. It just says, you know, sea level is rising in Virginia, which everyone who lives on the coast of Virginia knows. Sea level is rising, it's affecting Virginia, and it just says Scott Taylor cares. Now, his voting record doesn't really show that he has done anything but vote against any effort to curb greenhouse gases. So that's where the voters really have to really look closely at the records and not just the ads they're seeing from these candidates this election season.
Nathaniel, what stands out for you about what you've heard from candidates on climate change and the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really extraordinary is what's going on in Florida right now, both in the gubernatorial election, but also in some congressional races. So first, on the gubernatorial election, as perhaps many of your listeners remember, right after the primary, Ron DeSantis, the Republican nominee, made a racially charged comment about the governor's race. And his opponent, Mayor Andrew Gillum, who's African-American, was asked about this in one of the debates. And what Gillum, how Gillum responded was really extraordinary. He said, "You know what? I'm black. I've been black my whole life. So far as I know, I will die black." And everybody laughed. And then he pivoted. Then he said, "But this is the point. The only color that the people of the state of Florida care about is the blue-green algae flowing from the east and the west side of this state." I mean, when was the last time anybody pivoted away from talking about racism to talk about the environment as though the environment were a top-tier issue? But it is. I mean, Andrew Gillum thought, rather than take advantage of my opponent's just potentially awful comment, I'm going to talk about the environment because that's what I think the people of Florida want. And a second example from Florida that I think is also pretty extraordinary is in the 26th Congressional District, where Carlos Corbello is running against Debbie Mercosell Powell. And Carlos Corbello, for better or for worse, and people can argue about this, is at least seen as having a pretty good environmental record. What's really interesting is the National Republican Congressional Committee, so the head campaign arm of Republicans running for Congress, has made an ad attacking the Democrat for taking donations from coal companies. Now, it's not every day you see Republicans vilifying the coal industry, but I think this illustrates that environmental issues are becoming such a high priority, not across the country, but at least in certain areas, that even Republicans are falling all over themselves to try to present themselves to voters as paying attention to these issues. And I think this is just it's a very important thing to understand. It's why it's so important to vote, because politicians go where the votes are.
I want to jump in here and add that the NRCC ad in the 26th district that said Corbello's opponent is taking dirty coal money, it doesn't seem that she has any donations from coal companies. The Republican congressional candidates, however, that are the major place where the coal industry is putting its money. So again, this is really something that can be confusion and obfuscation for the voters who are trying to figure out, you know, especially if they're very sincere about wanting to have somebody who'll do something on the environment. They can't always take the candidate's words, but have to look at their actions.
Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization that focuses on climate change, energy, and the environment. We're also joined today by Nathaniel Stinnett, founder of the Environmental Voter Project, an organization that works to get more environmentalists to the polls. They found that 15 million people who really care about the planet do not vote. And so they're trying to encourage them to vote this time around. These people did not vote in the 2014 midterms. If you have any questions or comments on this, climate change really deserves a lot more attention this midterm. And so what questions do you have about this? We'll talk about some propositions on the ballot that would affect the planet. We are talking about candidates and where they stand on the planet and climate change. What are your thoughts in your area? Are you voting on a specific issue that affects climate change and the environment? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Since you both mentioned money, Marianne, last week we did a show about just the wave of cash that is breaking records once again. We're expecting about $5.2 billion with a B, that will be spent on the midterms. And this time around, the Democrats have actually caught up. We talked a bit about the Koch brothers. They always pour hundreds of millions of dollars into elections. And of course, they have major oil and gas interests. Marianne, what else can you tell us about how the oil and gas industry, what else are they spending their money on this election?
Well, one of the most interesting places they're spending it is in Washington State. They're pouring $30 million into an effort, a campaign against a voter initiative, a ballot initiative, to put a fee on carbon. That would be the nation's first carbon fee. All of the revenue from it would go to encouraging renewable energy, encouraging helping pay for energy efficiency, and also helping workers with a transition to a clean energy economy. That is a record amount of money. No other ballot initiative has ever drawn that kind of money in Washington State. BP is at the top of the list. The Koch brothers are not too far down that list of folks who want to stop that in its tracks. And it's not so much that one state imposing a ballot initiative is going to make that much of a difference, but if Washington State can do it, it becomes kind of this example that other states and the federal government and Congress might be able to follow. And so they want to stop that movement in its tracks. Important to say a carbon fee or carbon tax or however you want to put it, putting a price on carbon is the way that economists say is just makes the most sense for trying to just deal with the market issue of getting us transitioned off of fossil fuels.
And so if you have any friends or colleagues in Washington, that initiative is 1631. And Vox reports that the No on 1631 campaign has raised $26 million. As Marianne mentioned, BP, almost $5 million, or I'm sorry, $10 million. Phillips 66, $7 million. And then the Yes side has raised about $15 million, mostly from environmental organizations. And you also mentioned Colorado. That's Proposition 112. Can you tell us about Prop 112, Marianne?
Yes. So this is a proposition to require that fracking operations be set back about 2,500 feet from homes, businesses, and also sensitive areas like parks and streams. Once that got on the ballot, there was an effort by really opponents of that to put another item on the ballot, and that is requiring that those oil companies and natural gas companies be compensated by the government if they are affected by the setback proposition. So it's almost like a poison pill for the setback proposition. Colorado is really interesting because the Democrat who is running for governor, Jared Polis, opposes this setback provision. And this is kind of in the tradition of the Democrats in Colorado being trying to be moderate, trying to appeal to how big the oil industry is in that state. So that state for years has had a lot of tension about the impact that fracking operations are having on communities, and this is the latest effort to really get some local control on that.
Well, that definitely shows in the money, the fact that mainstream environmental groups and the Democratic Party think it goes too far. The group backing the initiative, Colorado Rising, has raised about $800,000 from groups like Food and Water Watch. And then on the other side, $35 million from oil and gas companies. So you've got $35 million versus $800,000 on Prop 112 in Colorado.
Right. Very, kind of says it all about the money and power on that one.
Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News, and Nathaniel Stinnett is founder of the Environmental Voter Project. This is a group that works to get more environmentalists to the polls. And today we are talking about climate change, the environment, and the midterm elections. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, wow, it is Election Day, one of the most crucial in our lifetimes. I know we say that almost every Election Day, but this one is so, so important. If the Democrats do not take back the House, we will see so many changes, inequality, tax cuts for the wealthy, even more environmental destruction. Early voting is breaking records across the country, and we are seeing that young voters are going to the polls in droves. So we're going to open the lines tomorrow on Election Day. Find out what you're watching and how you're making your voice heard. Today, we are talking about climate change, the environment, and the midterms. I really wish climate change had gotten more media attention this time around because there are so many crucial issues on the ballot, and we are facing just, well, ever so many things, floods, wildfires, tornadoes. We have the new report from the IPCC saying that we've got just 12 years to limit a catastrophe. So we're talking about it today with Marianne Lavelle, an award-winning reporter with Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonpartisan organization focused on all of these crucial issues. If you care about these issues, I hope you check out Inside Climate News regularly. And Nathaniel Stinnett is founder of the Environmental Voter Project. They are working to get more environmentalists to the polls. They found that in the last midterm in 2014, 15 million people who care about the environment did not vote. So if you have any questions or comments about this, we would love to hear from you. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. There was a documentary called Tidewater. That was put out last year, and it was specifically about the Tidewater Norfolk area in Virginia, which has the largest naval center in the world, military. And, you know, I'm just wondering on the ground, not just in the commercials, you know, what's going on in that entire area, because we're talking an area that regularly has flooding. Streets are flooded, and this is the number one place for military preparedness, disaster preparedness in the country.
Bill, where is this? I'm sorry, I had to cough.
Norfolk, Virginia, Tidewater
Norfolk,
area.
Norfolk, Virginia.
I mean,
thank you.
If you look at a map, I mean, this place is just way open to flooding.
Yes,
Marianne.
It includes the naval station at Norfolk, Virginia Beach, and that area. Everyone who lives there knows that they are really under threat because of sea level rise, the more exposure to storms, etc. So, in the congressional district that covers that area, Virginia's second. You have two naval veterans running against each other. The incumbent, he's a former Navy SEAL. He is a Republican, and he has really been positioning himself as an environmentalist. He talks about how he has tried to protect the Chesapeake Bay. He did take some votes against the majority of Congress that wanted to weaken the environmental protections for the Chesapeake Bay. And he actually has come out this year in opposition to Trump's plan to open up the Atlantic coast to offshore drilling. That's a very unpopular idea on the coast there. However, Taylor voted against an effort to block Trump's drilling plan, really as recently as this summer. And he has voted to weaken the government's mandate to coordinate with state and local communities like the ones in Virginia's second on ocean management. So his opponent, who is a nuclear engineer and Navy veteran, Elaine Luria, argues that he only provides lip service to environmental issues. And she says he votes the wrong way when he thinks no one is looking. So this is an example, a perfect example, about how climate change has now really become an elevated district issue in a congressional district that really is affected by it. And we will see that district. It has been trending blue. It voted for the Democrat in last year's governor's race. We'll see what happens. It's still considered a toss-up.
Marianne, do you happen to know, are these issues getting the attention they deserve in local papers and at the local level?
I think they're getting more attention at the local level than they are at the national level. But, it, you know, I think we have to say that local coverage is not what it was 20 years
right.
ago anywhere in the country. So I think we have to say here, this show, I'm sure, will run out of time talking about all the places where climate change is an issue. But in the national news coverage, it is just a footnote, and it really has to be elevated to an important as important an issue as any other that we're facing. And I think what we're seeing in these races is telling us that this is bubbling down at the ground bubbling up at the ground level, and we really should be paying attention to it.
So true. Well, thank you for calling, Bill. We have a question for you, Nathaniel, from a caller who couldn't stay on. How do you know that being an environmentalist reduces someone's chance of voting, as opposed to being like a feminist or an animal rights activist?
So it's a great question. And I wouldn't quite put it that way. It's not that simply being an environmentalist reduces your likelihood of voting. It's that when we are able to identify environmentalists on the voter file, we can then look and see who voted and who didn't vote. And in the 2016 election, the 2014 election, the 2012 election, in all of the recent elections we've looked at, the people we're able to identify as deeply caring about environmental issues vote less often than all registered voters or all eligible voters. Now, what is the causal relationship going on there? I'm not going to pretend like I know. It's extraordinarily hard for behavioral scientists to figure out why someone does not take an action. What's kind of easy for economists and psychologists and other people to look at is they say, oh, let's set up an experiment to figure out how to get someone to vote or how to get someone to exercise or how to get someone to eat healthy. It's really hard to figure out the opposite. It's really hard to figure out why someone is not voting. I would not claim that these people aren't voting because they are environmentalists. But what we do know is that people who tend to deeply care about environmental issues simply vote less often. And that's obvious on the voter file.
You know, something you said earlier I think is so true. I met someone recently at a concert who seems to be pretty conscious about issues. We had a nice conversation, and then I asked him about voting, and he says he doesn't vote. And I just got so angry, and he said, I just don't believe in the system. I feel it's totally corrupt, and the politicians don't care about us. I said, yes, but what about local issues? And he said, I just don't believe in the system.
Right. And what's frustrating about that, and I imagine there are a lot of your listeners who are thinking this right now, Rose. They say, oh, you know, my vote doesn't matter, or I live in a district where I already know who's going to win. Our votes matter more than most people even imagine. And the reason is this. This is the lifeblood of all modern politics. Who you vote for is secret. but whether you vote or not is public record. It's public record. And let's say, Rose, let's say you're running for governor of California, okay? And I'm running your campaign. You know what the first thing we do is? We look at the public voter file, and we decide, okay, with our limited time and our limited money, who are we going to talk to, and who are we not going to talk to? And you better believe that we're not going to waste our time talking to people whose public records show that they never, ever vote. And so to everybody who thinks that their vote doesn't matter, you need to realize that voters are the only people who matter. Politicians know who vote and who doesn't vote. And surprise, surprise, they don't really care about your opinions if you don't vote. They're not going to poll you. Yeah, they're not going to do any of that.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I was thinking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She specifically said her campaign spent about a year reaching out to non-voters, people who fall into this category, who believe that the system isn't working for them. But when the volunteers talked to them about their issues and looked at them in the eye, they got a lot of non-voters to go to the polls.
Right. And that's the approach that we take at the Environmental Voter Project. We're not going to assume that there are a million Ocasio-Cortezes out there, because there aren't. We're going to assume that most politicians are going to go where the votes are, because that's what most politicians do. Either you go where the votes are, or you don't get to be a politician anymore. And so that means most campaigns really only talk to the good voters or the drop-off voters, the people who vote kind of infrequently. But if the majority of environmentalists never vote or rarely vote, well, then no one's ever going to talk to them. So the approach we take at the Environmental Voter Project is, let's not worry about winning the next election. There are a ton of groups who do that, who endorse candidates and help them get elected. Let's instead worry about changing the electorate. And so our approach is, we go into a state, we find all the non-voting and seldom voting environmentalists, and then we talk to them in every election, even if it's for library trustee or city council or dog catcher, because if we're able to get these people to vote, that becomes a public record, and then politicians will fall over themselves trying to appeal to those people, because nothing motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election. If environmentalists vote, politicians will follow. Like, they'll have to, or they won't get elected.
What are your thoughts about how movements affect all of this? I'm thinking about Standing Rock. I'm thinking about all of the climate change activism that's happening on the streets. Indigenous activists are leading the way. How does that factor into all of this?
I think it's enormously important, because there's no denying that the climate crisis and other environmental issues can often become so overwhelming that they paralyze us. And obviously, paralysis is not really a good response to any problem, let alone the climate crisis. And so whether it be marches, whether it be protests, any movement that empowers people who care about the environment and care about climate change, to any movement that makes them realize that they actually can make a difference, is doing an enormous amount of good. Now, I would claim it's also important to take the next step and vote whenever there's an election, because politicians don't care about who's on the street. They care about who's in the polls. But
that was my question. Do you think that the movements will translate into more voting and more votes on these issues?
I can give
Marianne?
You an example of the movement really translating into activism, and that is what has happened with scientists. You may remember last year the March for Science last spring, and it really was started by scientists who were upset at what was happening with the devaluation of science and by the incoming administration and by decision making. Well, that has really translated to a record number of scientists running for office. And there's more than a dozen running for Congress. That is only the tip of the iceberg. There are scientists running at state and local levels and really having an impact, because in the races that we looked at, they are forcing their opponents to really attempt to rebrand themselves and appeal to voters who are also concerned about the environment. And that really is something that started as, you know, we're going to march on Washington and all these cities. But even while that march was being planned, there was a feeling that this won't have meaning unless it translates into actually electoral power and political power.
I think that's so right. I think Marianne is absolutely right. And we also need to understand that these movements, these protests, these marches are actually much closer to the act of voting than they are to other ways that environmentalists express themselves. I mean, we often think of voting as one person by him or herself going into a secret spot to vote, but deep down we all know that there is a very small likelihood that our one individual vote will ever affect the outcome of an election. No, the true power of voting that we all understand deep down is that movements affect electoral change. And so these movements that are politicizing environmental issues are making people understand that when we move as a group, there can be an enormous amount of power. And in many ways, it's much more powerful than the individual things that we do at home as environmentalists. Many people are changing how they eat, or changing how they get to work, or recycling, or changing how they consume electricity, all of which are very important and impactful. But when you link arms and stand with thousands of other people to protest or to demand something, you feel empowered and you understand that marching to the polls actually isn't that different from marching down Main Street. They have a lot in common.
We have an email from Billy who says, if environmental groups are raising millions of dollars against these important propositions, we mentioned the props in Colorado and Washington earlier, where is the disconnect in getting the vote of their members out? Nathaniel?
Well, that's a very good question, Billy. I think part of what's going on is when there is a ballot measure, and I say this as someone who runs an organization that doesn't endorse candidates and doesn't support ballot measures, we're more like rock the vote is for the environment. But if I were trying to make a particular ballot measure succeed, well, my goal is not the long-term health of the environmental movement. My goal isn't to drag someone out from under a rock who's never voted before. My only goal is to get 50% plus one of the vote on a Tuesday in November. That's all I care about if I'm trying to win a ballot measure. And oftentimes, the easiest way to make that happen is to find people who already have a history of voting and trying to persuade them to support your ballot measure. Sometimes that's the most efficient way to win one election. Now, that's not what we do at the Environmental Voter Project, because we're more concerned about changing the electorate. But to answer Billy's question, if all you care about is winning one election, electing one person or winning one ballot measure, sometimes the smartest thing is not to find the truly awful voter. Sometimes the smartest thing is to persuade the good voter that they should vote for you.
Nathaniel Stinnett is founder of the Environmental Voter Project, an organization that's working to get more environmentalists to the polls. 15 million people who said that the environment was very crucial did not vote in the midterms in 2014. They're working to change that. Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News, a nonprofit that focuses on climate change, energy, and the environment. Candidates? Oh, Marianne, did you want to jump in?
Well, what Nathaniel was saying, it just made me think of this. I mean, he's working, and his folks are working on changing the environmental voters so that they become more active. The other thing that's going on is candidates are trying to appeal to voters who are not thought of as environmental voters, but to try to get them to be in touch with how they should be environmental voters. There's a candidate in Iowa's Northwestern Congressional District, the 4th Congressional District, this former minor league baseball player. He's going around the whole state, 39 counties in a Winnebago, and he is talking to farmers. That this is a state with 88,000 farms. 20% of the population depends on farming. What is happening to the climate is an existential threat to their business and their industry. And really, all three of the challengers of three climate-denying members of Congress in that state are talking about climate really in not the same way perhaps it is talked about in Florida or in Virginia, but as, hey, this is a reality and our political leaders are not dealing with it. And we could be in the forefront of being a solution on climate change instead of being just the victims of it. And there's a sign that that's really resonating with people. So they're kind of trying to broaden the number of people who are voting on environmental issues, as well as the issue of people who already care about the environment, getting them out to vote.
Marianne, are candidates also linking these issues with the health and your pocketbook? Because we're getting so much new information about how pollution affects our health. It could lead to so many things like asthma, which means possibly a visit to the emergency room, which is very expensive. Are candidates talking about it like that?
I think that that's definitely part of the discussion in Washington state. Remember, that state has been just so affected by wildfires over the last 2 years. Seattle's air quality was worse than it has ever been on record this past mm-hmm. August, and it's because of the wildfires all around it. And so when people go to vote this tomorrow there, I think that's something they're going to remember. And the American Lung Association and several physicians groups are in favor of that ballot initiative on health grounds.
And what would you add, Nathaniel? Are you hearing candidates drawing these connections?
Yes, absolutely. Now, part of the reason we're hearing them make those connections is because when you simply talk about climate change as, say, an environmental issue, people kind of tune out. It just is what it is. Unfortunately, there aren't too many people who care deeply about it because it's an environmental issue. But there are lots of people who do care about it as a public health issue, as an economic issue, and it also, to be blunt, makes for better ads. It makes for better talking points when you talk about asthma. I mean, there are very few things as horrifying as seeing a child have an asthma attack. Mm. To the extent someone can make that the face of climate change, that is going to be far, far more compelling a message than the infinitesimal creep of sea level rise somewhere 1,000 miles away. We need to stop making climate change this big, paralyzing, weird thing hiding around the corner and start talking about the stuff that's actually happening in our communities. And that's not just me saying that. Obviously, there are lots of very smart political operatives and communicators and politicians who are starting to talk about it in that way. And you see that most in these ballot questions. Because there, when you have a ballot question, you have no choice but to vote on it. You're either going to vote yes or no. There's a digital option presented to you. And so you have to find the most compelling way to get voters to support your initiative. And that's where you see some of this really interesting creative messaging.
Well, in our final 30 seconds, Nathaniel, based on what you're hearing from your volunteers, do you think that we're going to see more environmentalists go to the polls tomorrow?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen more environmentalists vote. We've had 35 million people vote early, whereas only 20 million voted in 2014. And the biggest gains are from young people, African Americans, and Latinos. And those are three demographic groups that care more about the environment than any other demographic group.
Wow. Marianne, those are huge numbers, just quickly.
Yes, and it's important to know that this election really does make a difference, because what happens in the House, what happens in these governorships that are so important on clean energy, that will matter to the direction we go on in climate change in the coming months and years.
Marianne Lavelle is an award-winning reporter covering the environment for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit organization focused on climate change. Marianne, thank you for all of your great work, and thanks again for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Nathaniel Stinnett is founder of the Environmental Voter Project, an organization that is working to get more environmentalists to vote. In 2014, 15 million people who said they really cared about the environment did not vote, and it looks like we are seeing changes this time around. Nathaniel, thanks to you and all of your volunteers for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it is Election Day, and this election will determine the future of so many crucial issues. If the Democrats don't take back the House, we will see more inequality, tax cuts for the wealthy, environmental destruction, and so much more. As you just heard, early voting is breaking records across the country, and young people are going to the polls in droves. The world is really watching this election. We're going to open the lines to find out what you're watching and how you are making your voice heard. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, who's our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.